This is a republic if you can keep it, with former Democratic Party Chairman Mark Brewer and former Republican Party Executive Director Jeff Timmer.
Welcome back to A Republic If You Can Keep It. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. The political world was shaken and stirred, with apologies to James Bond, this week by the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion overturning Roe versus Wade. We'll take a deep dive into the political implications for Michigan on that and the takeover of the party by Donald Trump. And then we'll be joined by longtime political activist and professional communicator par excellence, Bill Nowling.
We begin our nonviolent weekly legitimate political discourse over the week's developments. And Mark, you mentioned the big news, kind of the potentially earth-shaking news of the leak of the draft majority opinion that will overturn Roe versus Wade more than 50 years after that decision was handed down by the Supreme Court. There's so many implications that this has on politics, on culture, on healthcare, on so many things. So, you know, what's your first take on this?
Well, frankly, the result was not a surprise. Anybody who's been watching this closely, listen to oral argument, thought there was five votes there to overturn Roe. But this is classic Alito. I mean, you know, the court verified that this was an actual document, wasn't generated by some AI computer somewhere. It was a draft. Court has not reached agreement on it yet. But it's classic Alito. Go straight after Roe. It was wrong for all these reasons. We overturn it. Done. We return the issue to the people. That will come as no surprise, I think, to most people in the country. The question is whether that opinion survives until, you know, late June, early July, which is when the court typically issues its opinions. There's a lot of speculation that Chief Justice Roberts is trying to peel off one of the five and get the court to stop somewhere short of overturning Roe. But there's no question that this was a political earthquake this week and really grabbed the attention of people. I mean, people like me have been saying for a long time, Roe's in jeopardy, it's going to get overturned. But there's nothing like the issuance of the leaking of a draft opinion to grab people's attention. And the political rhetoric got ramped up. The petition drive here in Michigan saw record numbers of volunteers. Right to Life and the Catholic Church were joyful about this and looking at their next steps. So this really, really dominated the news this week, and I think could become a big issue in the fall campaign, Jeff.
Well, I'm a cynic and maybe see some Machiavellian work here. When Chief Justice Roberts kind of corroborated that, yes, this is a real draft and announced that they're going to do this investigation, to me, that screams he's the one who leaked it, because he's the one who's most concerned about the political ramifications and the way this court looks. And it would be brilliant strategy for him to be the one to leak this and then conduct the investigation in an effort to try to pull this back from the brink. From issuing a majority opinion that he thinks will have the potential to tear this country already at a serious divide even further and have great what he would see perhaps as adverse political implications. And so it wouldn't surprise me if the leak came from somebody like that who's taking the kind of the big picture view of the court, although the case can be made, and I've seen it made, that it comes from one of the dissenters, it comes from it could come from any number of sources, but it would be brilliant if someday way down on the road we find out that, yeah, it was Roberts that slid this to Politico.
Yeah, no, I really do think, and of course I wasn't there when all these things happened, but look, I mean, Dred Scott was a huge impact politically on this country, and we've had other big cases like that. If this comes down this way, I think it could have a similar effect on the country. Now, Roberts can't control that, but I think he is legitimately concerned about the court's institutional integrity. I'd be very surprised if he was the leaker. It just doesn't seem in his nature to do that. I think the other theories that are out there are more plausible. But, you know, that is what it is. It's out there. I don't think this has ever happened in the history of the United States Supreme Court. We've had leaks, but not of entire opinions in such a seminal case. It's just remarkable to me as a lawyer to see this happen, let alone the political implications.
Yeah. Well, is, you know, we've both operated around the inside of campaigns for a long time. And we know from experience that, you know, the cake kind of gets baked when it comes to the macro environment for any election year. And, you know, I guess we might have different ideas about exactly when that occurs. But usually I always think that kind of by the 4th of July or the middle of the summer, kind of the environment is what it's going to be. You know what the weather is going to be like for that day and whether you need to dress light or put on a jacket, right, as you head into the fall. And so it's too early to tell, but this definitely has the prospect of reshuffling the macro environment for this election year, where it was all set to be a referendum on the Biden presidency and the concern about inflation and the frustration over the longevity of COVID, and just the people were just mad and frustrated and weary of politics and everything. In the headwinds were certainly blowing against the Democrats and may still be. But I'm going to be very interested to see now the enthusiasm gap that they talk about in intensity and likeliness to vote among those partisan Republicans versus partisan Democrats. If that starts to narrow, if those generic ballot tests start to narrow or move, if that macro environment does start to shift in these next 60 days or so before we hit that kind of point where the cake gets baked for the election year and we know what the weather is going to be like.
Yeah, I tend to think that the environment gets set a little earlier than that, Jeff. I usually like about this time of year, you know, because the economic trends are pretty clear unless something extraordinary happens, like a war, right? But I agree with you. This has the potential, I think, to really help Democrats. There is an enthusiasm gap on the part of Democrats, right? And it's always the problem with the party in power. Right. There's inevitably disappointment. People been watching the sausage get made. They didn't like a lot of the sausage. They didn't like how it got made. Wasn't their sausage, whatever. I don't want to carry the metaphor too far. But this, I think, could help with, you know, close that enthusiasm gap and motivate good parts of the Democratic base, as well as if it's handled right, which is what we're going to talk to Bill Nowling about. If it's handled right, it can also be a bridge to people who aren't part of either party's base, but who are concerned or personally affected or could be personally affected by the overturning of Roe. What will it mean for them, for their daughters, their mothers, you know, their sisters, other kinds of people that it could personally affect? And you're right. We'll have to see how it plays out. But boy, I don't know about you, but my Twitter account, my email just blew up with Roe messages from Democrats. You probably don't need as many of those as I did. Once this came out, the political leak, and it hasn't stopped. It's just been a deluge of that. And it seems like nobody on the Democratic side is missing an opportunity to, frankly, take advantage of this and talk about the importance of protecting choice and how they're going to stand up and be counted. I don't hear as much from the Republican side or Right to Life in terms of applauding it. They've tend to focus more on, wasn't this leak terrible? You know, more the process message. And I'm wondering whether they think, well, maybe we're the dog that finally caught the car and now we don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right there. I think that the clear-eyed professionals on the right and the Republican campaign operatives who aren't morons know that this is not a political winner for their side, that this is not something that's going to be, that it's been great to use the issue of abortion to motivate those who are those single issue voters, to always keep slightly out of reach is to keep them motivated and in the arena. But without that motivation, they know that this is one, it can have somewhat of a demotivating factor on their side, but it's clearly motivates the pro-choice side, the Democrats, the majority of people, even who are pro-life or anti-abortion who are against overturning Roe, who don't want to criminalize abortion. It's a political loser for Republicans. The only thing that those same smart political strategists on the Republican side are counting on is for the Democrats to be Democrats when it comes to how they'll go too far in how they capitalize on this opportunity to reset the election year, that they'll push this out to those extremes, that the voices of the most strident on either side of the issue will be the ones that predominate and again cause those sane people in the middle to say enough, to lessen that enthusiasm and get past this moment of anger, of concern, of fear, whatever it is right now that people are feeling, that will wane over these few months. And that's what they're counting on.
Yeah, we're just going to have to see how it all plays out. I mean, obviously, we've got stark contrast up and down the ballot on this issue between the governor and all of her opponents, down to the attorney general's race. I've even seen Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson messaging about this, even though obviously abortion and choice are not within her purview. It's going to be, again, up and down the ballot. Speaking of that, though, there were some other things that happened this week. We did have a handful of special elections in Michigan and some elections in other states. That may give us a little insight, but I don't want to exaggerate. Looks like, basically with status quo in Michigan with the four specials, with one exception, that this R.J. Regan, out in a very strong Republican pro-Trump House district, got clobbered, actually. And a Democrat took more than 50% of the vote and won the special election for the state house in the Grand Rapids area. What's your take on what happened there, Joe?
I think your caution is the best advice here, to not read too much into the result. But I think the Democrats should be very heartened by the message that I think was evident last night. Can't underscore enough how strong this district was for Trump. Trump beat Biden in this district in 2020, a suburban Kent County around Grand Rapids. Beat Joe Biden by a margin of 24 points. Got like 64 to 36 kind of margin here, right? Or I guess that's 28 points. Big math is hard. But it was a big margin. And you're right. The Democrat got a majority of votes. There was a division on the Republican side. The Republican was as extreme a lunatic as you can imagine in today's extreme lunatic world of Republican politics. This is the guy who was out proudly talking anti-Semitic, misogynist, racist, anti-Ukraine, pro-Putin, and then most infamously on a recorded show proudly said that, he's told his daughters if they're ever experiencing rape to lie back and enjoy it, and then doubled down on that when it came out. Okay, so this guy's, kind of disqualified, and the Republicans backed away from him. He didn't have a lot of the institutional support, didn't have money, and didn't have funding, but you shouldn't need it in a district that's that strongly Republican. There was a write-in candidacy mounted by kind of the establishment Republicans to try to hopefully beat this guy. But that wasn't what tipped the scales. Even if there hadn't been, when you add in all the write-in votes, the Democratic candidate still won a solid majority, 53% of the vote in this special election district. Now, that doesn't mean that this is going to suddenly be like this wave coming and Democrats need to be looking at Trump plus 20 districts. But what it shows me is that there's many primaries, especially when you look at these newly redrawn congressional and especially legislative districts where we have crowded primaries, where there's not necessarily a target-rich environment like R.J. Regan, who talks about, enjoyable rape, but where you get these lunatic candidates coming through, the fringe candidates of the most Trumpy of this Trump party emerging from these crowded primaries by winning 25 or 30% of the vote. And suddenly they're the ones who are the standard bearer for the party in the fall. And the coalition of the sane, especially in a district where there's a higher income more college degrees, that kind of a suburban phenomenon that we're seeing, where those voters are moving quickly away from the Republican Party, where they're going to look and say, look, that's not my circus, not my monkeys. I don't want anything to do with that party. When a candidate like Reagan, or even Reagan, you know, 80% Reagan comes through, I would advise the Democrats to be looking at these seats. Not necessarily the Trump plus 20 districts, but certainly the Trump plus 5 districts, which the Democrats will now have an incumbent in the newly redrawn district around Kent County. That's city of Walker and Granville, for those who are really in the weeds, and part of the city of Grand Rapids. Now, it's a district that Joe Biden won. They're going to have an incumbent there rather than a Republican that they have to oust. And you got a Democrat incumbent that's one seat. Well, that's how narrow the contest for control of the state house and the state legislature might be. It could come down to what happened last night and the fact that the Democrats have an incumbent now running for reelection in that district, versus a challenger trying to oust a Republican incumbent.
Right, well, that's great analysis, Jeff. I also want to point out, on the other side of the state, in Macomb County, a Trumper won a special election, and he's much more, you know, to the right and part of the Trump wing of the party than the Republican he replaced. So I think that demonstrates that you can win as a Trumper in the Republican primaries in this state. You just can't be crazy like Reagan was. Whether anybody will pay attention to that message remains to be seen. Doesn't seem like Christina Caramo or DiPerno have changed their behavior in the last 24 hours. But I think you're right. I think there's a lesson here for folks going forward that, you know, you can't count on some of these seats that we otherwise wouldn't think of as a swing seat. If you nominate somebody out there who's really crazy and offensive like Reagan was.
Yeah. Well, that seat in Macomb County that you talked about, very interesting dynamic taking place that was vacant because the former state representative won a special election to the state Senate, Doug right. Wozniak. Well, after redistricting, Doug Wozniak, the newly minted senator who's been there like, you know, 5 minutes, was thrown into a district with incumbent senator and former Secretary of State Ruth Johnson. So newly minted Senator Doug Wozniak chose not to run for reelection to the Senate seat he just won. He's going to ride out the Senate seat for the remainder of the year. But now in August, he's going to be running against the guy who just won last night who filled the seat to replace him. So there we're going to see, does I don't know if Trump will weigh in and endorse the winner from last night,
Terrence McCaskey.
Okay. Or not, but that would be an interesting place to see if Trump were to endorse, over Wozniak, the current state senator, former state representative running again for that seat. That will be an interesting, experiment to watch.
Right. I think that's right. You know, but we saw Trump's strength, just to mention, in other states. This J.D. Vance got the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. You know, he got a late Trump endorsement, which appears to have pushed him across the finish line. So, again, I think you and I have reflected on this before. This idea that Trump's influence is waning, I think, is mistaken. We continue to see evidence of it, particularly in some of these Midwest states, which are so important to Trump when he runs again in 2024.
Before we introduce our guest and go into that conversation, I want to bring up my favorite news of the week, and that's gubernatorial candidate, Republican gubernatorial candidate, Tudor Dixon, who's one of the crowded field of 10 candidates and one of the ones who's being her candidacy is being challenged due to deficient petition signatures that she filed, and the deficient perhaps fraudulent as well. But it was revealed this week that she did a stint as an actress in what's being called a softcore vampire series, very poorly acted Cinemax style. I think that means that Trump is now more likely to endorse her if she's scantily clad or in any way unclad, that the chances of a Trump endorsement just went up with this news. But it just kind of shows the kind of clownish, almost unbelievable characters that are running as Republicans these days and seen as front, kind of the top tier candidates.
Right. But I got to tell you, Jeff, I'm getting pretty cynical about whether this makes any difference with the voters. Right. I mean, maybe 10 or 20 years ago, this might have been something. But, you know, given that Trump got elected after all the sexual escapades and revelations and everything else and all the other things we've seen, I don't think this affects her electability inside the Republican Party, certainly at all. And maybe not with the general public. That's how much our standards have dropped over the last 20 years. Things that used to be scandalous are now basically, well, that's the way people are. Let's move on.
Right. Well, I think it could actually, you're right, it could work in her favor, not just the politics has become desensitized to things that were formerly scandalous, but the fact that this will get her some notoriety and attention in a field in which she's lagging in fundraising against some very well-heeled funders like Perry Johnson and Kevin Rinke. This could be worth a couple $1 million of free advertising for her as this news starts to make its way into the mainstream. I think it started to move on Twitter in the last couple of days. I haven't seen, it hit real big yet. I've certainly laughed about it a lot and laughed with a bunch of people. Like, of course, there's a, vampire porn actress in the Republican field. If somebody would have made me bet which of the Republican candidates had acted in vampire porn, I would have figured it was Perry Johnson. But, I was wrong.
Mark and Jeff are joined by veteran political advisor Bill Nowling. After these messages on A Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to be a sponsor of this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm whose principals have more than 4 decades of experience measuring public opinion on federal, state, and local issues, from who's ahead in a race for governor or Congress, to local support for a proposed zoning change.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, state agencies, local governments, and membership organizations across the state. Whether it's measuring voter opinions about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation enjoys public support, Epic MRA has been Michigan's premier go-to pollster for 30 years.
Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at The A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
'22 should be a banner year for Michigan Republicans, but what remains of the once grand old party seems intent on blowing it. The state GOP has already endorsed 2 big lie extremists for Secretary of State and Attorney General. Both Christina Carano and Mike DiPerno will provide opposition researchers with volume of juicy attack points. And all the top candidates for governor are also big lie promoters, whose extreme views on other issues give Governor Whitmer an advantage and a fighting chance to win the general election, assuming that James Gregg, Tudor Dixon, and Perry Quality Guru Johnson even get on the ballot, as their nominating petitions undergo challenges for forgery.
Add to it what we've been discussing, the impending demise of Roe versus Wade, and it appears the electoral gods have shifted perhaps toward the Democrats. Joining us to analyze the territory is a longtime friend and associate of mine within the Republican Party and Republican circles, Bill Nowling. Bill Nowling is the executive director of strategic communications at DP Plus. Previously, he was communications director for Wayne County, Michigan. Nowling has been a professional communicator for the better part of a quarter century and has advised governors, mayors, chief executives, and corporations on how to effectively communicate and manage change. More recently, Mr. Nowling has consulted on the Detroit municipal bankruptcy, the Flint water crisis, and the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to being a public relations practitioner, Mr. Nowling is a communications researcher and a PhD candidate in risk and crisis communication at Wayne State University. Bill, welcome to A Republic If You Can Keep It.
Hey, thank you.
It's great to talk with you. You and I have probably spent countless hours doing just this when we didn't have podcasts and things. And I'd love to have some of those memorialized, some of those conversations over coffee or beer. But I'm really glad to be talking to you today. And you know, the impetus, you and I were talking yesterday about the news out of the Supreme Court regarding Roe, and not just the politics of this, but how the language that is being used in the politics and the coverage of this and by the actors in the arena on this, how much the language matters. And, you know, this is something that certainly fits your area of expertise and now scholarly study. So I wanted to get your thoughts, you know, from this kind of 10,000 foot level, and then we can kind of drill down and talk a bit more about some of the politics and the political implications.
Boy, if the Democrats ever needed, you know, message manna from heaven to fall into their lap heading into a bad campaign year, this is it. You know, and I think the question is, you know, can they seize upon it and, to your point, build a broader coalition that gives a lot of the moderate people in the middle who voted Democrat but maybe voted Republican also, maybe they split their ticket, give them a reason to stay home in this election and in the congressional races. So I think, you know, a lot has to happen. And I look at it a little bit differently now than I did when I was more of a campaign operative. You know, campaign operative is all about the numbers. Where are we at with the number right now? And what does it move? And, you know, as a social scientist, I'm more interested in the trends of what is going on and what's going on with the rhetoric and the message around that. And if you look at kind of the historical polling trend over the last two decades, and let's just, you know, I looked at Gallup, as good as anybody else's, that you know, there's been what we social science geeks like to say, a significant shift in public perception and public acceptability around the idea of abortion. Although if you look at the numbers, you know, the raw numbers in the polling, it doesn't look like it's that big of one. But if people are moving off of the idea that there's a plurality around abortion with some restriction to abortion with no restriction. They've been moving in that direction over the last 10 years, and the numbers show that. And I think the reason for that is that it has become, you know, we're two generations into Roe v. Wade and Casey, and people have grown, you know, we've two generations that really have kind of grown up and come of age under this. And so this idea that abortion is something that is morally wrong is not as strong as it was before. But, and this is a big but, I think, for the progressives on this. If the knee-jerk reaction is to go right to kind of the dog whistle type messaging that we see, you know, that's not going to work, because while there is support for abortion with no restrictions, when you drill down into that data, it starts to peel off as you get further into the pregnancy, and then people become more uncomfortable with the idea. So, you know, abortion for under any reason in the first trimester, support is in the high 80s, but you get into the second or third trimester and that support falls off. So I think, you know, we got to kind of navigate the chute here a little bit to talk about what it means. And clearly, you know, the issue of health and safety of women is key. And talking about it in terms of health and safety, and talking about it more importantly, I think, in humanistic terms, as in terms of my daughter or my sister or my wife or, you know, my mother, you know, talking about it in those terms are going to be key to broadening that coalition. Because if it turns into, you know, my body, my choice type of fight, there's not a lot of room to keep moderates there. Moderates just won't get fired up for that type of message. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how the Democrats message this going forward, if they use it as an opportunity to kind of double down and ensconce this budding middle middle of the vote spectrum coalition that we saw the last two presidential elections. Can they use that to kind of solidify that?
So, Bill, so it sounds like personal testimony, as you just indicated, is really important. Personal stories.
Yeah.
What impact do you think the fact that Michigan statute is a criminal statute could have on the politics and on the message? Does that play a big role?
I do think that there is some, you know, there is an opportunity for a fear message here, but it's not, in my mind, it's not a fear message as opposed to, we can't go back to the way things were. We just can't. I mean, we've got two generations that have grown up under Roe v. Wade. I mean, this is the normal to them. Public perception has moved on beyond where the Supreme Court is. And they're going to rule the way that they're going to rule, but the population has moved on. And if you don't recognize that and say, you know, I think the opportunity is not to say, suddenly we're going to criminalize my daughter. Okay, that might work for some. But the bigger issue is, are we going to go back to the way things were 80 years ago? And for moderates, I think that that's a much stronger message to work with, because you have to realize that for the percentage of the population, of the voting population, that abortion is the deciding factor is probably 30%. And that is either way. And so there's not a lot of people that say, this is it. And where you come down on this issue is where I vote. It's not insignificant, but it's not where elections are going to be decided, I think. It's one of the issues. There's a plurality of people who say this is one of the issues that's important to know about. And I think it's important to know about this. But the more we get into talking about the mechanics of the law and the mechanics of the process, the more people, I think, turn off to this, you know. And I mean, we could talk all we want about, you know, this 1938 law or 1933 law that we have on the books and how bad it is. And it is bad. It's just not going to, in my mind, and I'm focus group of one, I admit that. And, you know, we're four white guys talking about, you know, matters, pretty affluent guys talking about matters that are really important to women of color and women who are in lower income brackets too. And so we have to be mindful of that. But from a number standpoint and a messaging standpoint, the opportunity is to say, we're not going back. And that's where we're going to, I think, keep people and build a broader coalition. Because if we go back and start with the, you know, with the placards from the 70s and the 80s on this, people are just going to turn off. And it's going to be impactful for people. It's impactful for, they're going to raise a crap ton of money, you know, for the various political campaigns on either side of it. But at the end of the day, is it going to move people to vote one way or the other? Probably not. But the key is, can we go into the election and say, this is why vote in the law matters. This is why sensible politicians matter. This is why sensible process, because we're not talking about, you know, this esoteric legal concept. We're talking about my daughter. We're talking about my mother or my grandmother or my sister or my coworker, you know, and that is, you know, and the anti-choice crowd have really made, have done a really good job of making this down to a single issue about babies. You know, it's like mom, apple pie, and Chevrolet. You know, nobody's against those things. And they were able to just to kind of digest this down to one single issue. And it fits on a hat, you know, for lack of a better, they've got a message that fits on a hat. We don't like it. It's not a message that is particularly enlightened, but it is a message that is effective. And there, you know, and that's what we're going to have to swim against to do that. The more we start, and Jeff will tell you this, explaining is losing. The more we start trying to explain this, the more we're going to have a hard time building the coalition or even keeping it together on this issue.
Do you think that slogans like, you know, my body, my choice, and those kinds of things then are not the kind of messaging that should be used here if you want to broaden the coalition?
I think, you know, it's a yes and message in my mind. That's an important message for a lot of women, and I get that. And but my point is that it's also it can be a divisive message, especially for moderates who intellectually they support reproductive rights, but never really had to be in a position to make that very, very difficult decision. Either, you know, they've never been poor, they've never been pregnant, they've had high, you know, they understood their body and they understood where they could get, you know, reproductive services and to help them. And they were empowered by that. So they've never been impacted by having to make that decision, but they're philosophically aligned with the decision.
Got it.
And so I think, you know, I think you have to, you know, when we're talking to the base, so by all means, that is a very strong message with the base. But we also have to say that, you know, this is a very personal decision that, you know, daughters and mothers and sisters have to make. And we're going to take that away. I mean, as a father of a daughter, I'm like, you're going to tell me some guy in D.C. or in Lansing is going to tell me what my daughter can or can't do when it comes to her body? I mean, come on. I mean, if in this world we can, with a straight face, argue that stand your ground legislation is somehow morally defensible under any circumstances, how is this any different in my mind? You know, if I feel a threat to my body, I should be able to protect it. And so, you know, I think that there's an opportunity to reason with folks in the public arena around this and saying, do we want to go back there? And I don't think most people do.
We spend a lot of time on our podcast every week talking to actors and talking about the politics of the day. And really the central organizing principle is kind of the threat or assault democracy has been under. And as strange as it may sound, I think that the leaking of this Roe decision may be the best thing for democracy. That I've been kind of like this Chicken Little, this foul mouthed Chicken Little running around on Twitter talking about the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And democracy and freedom are such, I don't know, nebulous, esoteric notions to most people that they can't imagine that they're going to go away. These actors on mostly these kooky Republicans are such malignant clowns that they're almost hard to take seriously as a threat because they're so cartoonish and ham-handed that it kind of defies our sense of reason that they're actually a threat to our way of life and our culture and in our future. And it takes something that's much more tangible like this to kind of wake up the silent majority that's out there. The majority of people, I say there are more of us than there are of them. And I say that's pro-democracy Americans, not necessarily Democrats, not necessarily left, but the coalition of the sane. The coalition of the sane over these last few years has grown weary. They're this week, they kind of woke up from that malaise, having tuned out. And this could be, you know, with 5 or 6 months to go here in this election year, the kind of shot in the arm that democracy is ultimately going to need to get this election back on fair footing, where the coalition of the sane has a chance to win in November.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jeff. And I mean, if we were running campaigns against some of these yummy heads, we would say, how can we send them more money to keep them on the air longer? Because, you know, the more people see them, the more people get turned off. But, you know, that doesn't always work. And we saw that in 16, and we almost saw it again 4 years later. So, you know, I think that's important to talk about that and to do this. And maybe it was a shock. Maybe it was a shock to the system that woke people up. I'm a bit more cynical about that, saying no. But I will tell you, and this might segue a little bit later into what we're going to talk about with Detroit. But, you know, the Detroit bankruptcy, nobody cared north of 8 Mile about Detroit bankruptcy until somebody wrote a story about us wanting to sell the art. And then suddenly what happened in Detroit mattered in Bloomfield Hills. And so maybe this is something like that can kind of make it real for somebody and say, hey, we're not going to do that again. You know, I read the Alito draft. It talked about the unsettled nature of abortion. I quite frankly think that the abortion issue is settled. 50% of the people are pro-choice, 50% of the people are pro-life, and it hasn't really moved off of those numbers over the last 25 years. So in that sense, it's settled. We're divided on this issue. Okay. We're divided over the Lions, too. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I've read the opinion as well. And this whole notion that, you know, this is not a settled issue and it didn't get settled by the previous court decisions. I think you're right, Bill. I mean, the history, you know, of the last, what are we now, 40, 50 years away from Roe, you know, people still feel very strongly about it. But we've settled into this, you know, this outline of how this works. And, you know, the idea that Alito is using somehow the idea that, you know, there's still agitation over this and it's not a settled question to justify overturning that that umbrella, that vehicle, is just really amazing. He's really out of touch with what's going on.
Well, he's out of touch, you know, and a friend of mine talked about the, you know, the Catholic majority in, you know, on the Supreme Court. And, he, you know, Justice Alito forgets his Thomas Aquinas, because one of the key concepts of Thomistic legal theory is that changes in law have to be weighed against, you know, I'd like to say, is the juice worth the squeeze, right? You know, are you going to create more problem by taking a moral action, what you believe to be a moral action, than by not taking it? And I think that they're ignoring. I mean, it's the whole point of precedents, is that, you know, we have precedents not necessarily because it's settled, but because we as a society have agreed that this is the reality that we live in. And we don't want people upsetting that. And I think that, that's important. I mean, this is an unprecedented leak. You know, I mean, I almost didn't believe it when I first saw it and heard about it, and I had to read it, read the opinion and go, oh, no, this is the memo. Now, the question is this the memo where all five of them are at, or is he shopping this around internally to get people on to say, you know, since we got the hood up, you know, this is the one and only chance we're going to get to do that. And I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what the final opinion is. But that there are five votes to overturn Roe v. Wade should not surprise anybody who's been watching the shift in the court over these last couple of years, certainly within the last administration. It was just a matter of how it was going to happen. And I think does it happen this way, which is very reactionary and very strident, or does it happen in some other, you know, way that's watered down a little bit?
Well, this is your reference to the Catholic justices on the court, because they represent a wing of the Catholic Church in this country. And I don't think it's the dominant wing at all. But over the course of time, the court has become full of people like Alito and Barrett and Kavanaugh. While they're Catholic, again, you know, in terms of their religious beliefs, it's an extreme part of the church. And I think many, many other members.
It's like Jim Gaffigan says, there's Catholics and then there's Taliban Catholics. And this is definitely the Taliban Catholic.
Oh, yeah. These are the ones that think Pope Francis is the false pope and Benedict is the true. And
yeah,
you know, you mentioned, this is a good time to switch gears a little bit. You referenced the Detroit bankruptcy, and that certainly was, you know, a big, ordeal, a big event here in Michigan, and dominated news here in the state for so long. And it's back in the news in the last week with the release of this documentary that I understand, you know, you have quite a bit of airtime in, or, you know, it featured in. So I'd love to hear, you know, your thoughts about, you know, have you, you've seen it?
Yeah, I watched it last week. So for the first time, I didn't see any of the pre-cuts. So,
okay. Well, maybe just to tell folks, you know, what it's called, you know, is it streaming somewhere where anybody's interested can see it, you know, and then, you know,
yeah, then it's called Gradually Then Suddenly. And, it's a documentary about how the city got to the point to where the emergency manager and emergency management was was brought in, and how it went into bankruptcy in the process of how it got out of bankruptcy. And so I won't belabor your viewers too much on it, but it should be available for streaming here in another, within a month. Part of the funding deal with the philanthropic agencies that help fund this was that it was going to be free of charge, and that's been kind of managed by the Detroit Free Press. But it should be available for streaming through one of the services, you know, within a month.
Was it something that was authorized and that you were participatory in during the bankruptcy?
No, they did it all. All the interviews were done afterwards. All the interviews were done. And, you know, when I first went in to work on this, you know, part of me wanted to, I said, we need to bring in a historian to kind of document what we're doing to do this. But the other part of me says, are you kidding? That has never worked out well for anybody who's ever brought that inside any kind of political operation.
Well, I can, we actually, in, I don't know if I've talked about this before on the podcast, but with the Lincoln Project in 2020, there was an outside documentary crew that we were cooperating with and that followed very inside the whole operation. And, you know, they were like here at my house for, you know, different days, you know, wake up in the morning and there's the documentary crew standing outside the window. And, you know, you're sitting in, you know, an office in Park City, Utah, with the gang talking. You got to the point where you were used to having the film crew around, and the documentary has never come out yet. But I dread what I might have said during that time when you kind of become numb to the fact that there's cameras there.
So. Yeah, no, they did this all afterwards, and it was all kind of, you know, the two shot type 60-minute setup, you know, where you're being interviewed by a producer and, you know, you're on camera, and then they started to stitch it together. And I mean, I think that they did a really, really good job given the complexity of the issue. And you know, I was sitting there watching them going, did we do that? Yeah, we did that. Things were happening so fast that you forget about it.
It was historic. I mean, it really was. It's the, you know, still, I think the largest municipal, you know, reorganization bankruptcy in history and may remain so. And so you guys kind of had to write the script as you went along. And it was a fascinating to watch from kind of afar and know somebody who was in it. And, you know, I had the peripheral role with the emergency manager statute and whatnot, you know, with the petition drive to overturn that. And so, I mean, I had a tangential relationship to it, but it's, I think, a fascinating subject, and I'm looking forward to watching it.
Yeah. It is good. I think anybody who is in big city municipal finance, whether they're elected officials or managers, need to look at that, because for however you come down on the need for the emergency manager or, you know, the law that they referred and then rewrote tougher and put into place, you know, we could argue about that all day, but the decisions that kind of started it down the road, you know, were financial decisions. They weren't necessarily political, you know, flat out political decisions. They were financial decisions. And it was really, you know, financial and economic decisions. And and not necessarily bad ones. They seemed good at the time. And when your choices are limited, you know, you can do that. And you make decisions that, you know, maybe you may look at it through a political lens and say, this is what I can get done. But if you look at it over a time, you know, this is what I can get done, but I'm not going to be here in 10 years when the chips are called. And that's, you know, and that's what happens. It just runs out of the fact that you have money to do that. They like to say about bankruptcy is that, you know, when when a hospital makes a mistake, they bury it. Literally. And, you know, when Wall Street makes a mistake, they just refinance. And that's exactly what they do. And that's what they did with Detroit. you know, Detroit needed cash. These guys were willing to make, you know, derivative side bet investments against them that, you know, you wouldn't take as, you know, with good points from Vegas. But when the city needs money and they can't pay firefighters, or they can't put money in their pension, you know, they do that. And as long as the interest rates work in your favor, it's a good deal until they flip. And that's exactly what happened.
Bill, any reflections that you could share with us, you know, as to how you think it's worked out since? I mean, you were a real insider here. How do you think this has worked out, or is it too early to tell?
You know, part of it's too early to tell. You know, there's some big IOUs coming due in like 2024 on some pension stuff, right, that the city's going to have to do that. But we did, by restructuring what the city owed and basically erasing it, a good portion of it, you know, we freed up $150 million a year for 10 years that was just straight off the top, went right into the city's bottom line and operational funds. So, I mean, that's real dollars that are going into programs, that and rejuvenating the city. So, you know, there's been some benefit to do that, but also I think that, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. You know, there's good benefits from it. And the biggest thing is that it, for 22 months, we stopped the political infighting because there was no profit in the political infighting because the decisions had been taken away from that, right, from the mayor and from city council. So we bought a respite. You didn't have to fight over the budget because that was going to be determined by the court, by the emergency manager. And so it gave Mayor Duggan an opportunity to build a relationship with council that was not as adversarial as it normally is, because they come right in and you're putting in a budget and there's all of this pressure that comes in there. And so I think it allowed them to coalesce around that. So when we got out of the way and left, that they were able to pick up and move forward and have some resources to do some things.
Right. And now they've got, you know, all the Rescue Act funds that have flowed over the last couple of years.
Yeah. I mean,
windfall as well.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of money that has come into Wayne County and the city of Detroit's really an unprecedented level, and be interesting to see how that plays out over the next 3 or 4 years as they start to spend that.
Well, Bill, our time has gone by very fast. We'd love, you know, we want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a great conversation. You know, you followed a very unique path to get where you are, from a, you know, a newspaper reporter to a Republican campaign operative and insider to the mouthpiece for the bankruptcy emergency manager in Detroit, to working with the Flint water crisis, and then the Wayne County executive, and now on the verge of being really smart and getting your PhD. So congratulations, and it's been great talking with you.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Bill. We're looking forward to your book on the Detroit bankruptcy.
So am I.
That is all the time we have for this week. Thanks again to my good friend Bill Nowling for his wisdom.
We want to hear from you. Send us your comments and questions, even if you think we're dead wrong on something. Send us an email at arepublicpodcast@gmail.com.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Jeff Timmer.
And I'm Mark Brewer. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on all major podcast sites. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.